to Psy.
Spend the day with Psy.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Psy Thursday Live.
Radio Psy Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Sai Ram. Radio Sai is pleased to present Professor Venkatraman, who will now deliver his 10th talk in the musings series on the Gita. What would he be speaking on today? Well, we will let the professor explain that. Over now to Professor Venkatraman.
Loving Sai Ram and greetings from Prashanti Nilayam. Today's talk will be on the Gita. If you recall, we have thus far navigated through 12 chapters of the Gita. Normally, today I should be dealing with chapter 13. Instead, I shall discuss the topic body and soul. Actually, this theme is touched upon in chapter 13. But it's also mentioned in several other chapters like 7, 8 and 15, for example. That is why this talk is on a particular topic rather than a particular chapter. By the way, this subject, namely the relationship of the body to the soul, is a pretty complex one because it goes to the core of the mystery of the universe. How does the transient exist in harmony with the eternal? If you think about it, the fate of an individual as well as of society as a whole depends critically on this delicate relationship. Understandably, therefore, this relationship or the harmony between the transient and the eternal is a complex subject because it covers the whole gamut from the individual level to the cosmic. You might wonder, why on earth should we bother about this topic? Is this not an esoteric diversion? My reply would be that a proper understanding of the subtleties of the complex relationship between the body and soul is needed if one is to adhere strictly to Mama Dharma, both in letter and in spirit. You see, the point is this. The body is a part of the physical universe, and both the body as well as the universe are gross in nature as well as impermanent. On the other hand, both have come from God, who is eternal. Thus, when we are discussing the relationship of the body and soul, we are really dealing with how the perishable and the imperishable coexist in the physical universe. If we have a proper understanding of this, then it would immensely benefit the individual in acting properly in the real world, keeping the permanent in perspective all the time. In case you find this difficult to absorb, let me remind you again what Swami says in the Gita Vahini. He says that while we live and act in a transient world, our actions must always be based on considerations of the permanent rather than the temporary. That is why the topic I am presently considering and discussing is of vital importance. I am sure all this would be sounding quite confusing and mysterious to you, so let me add some explanatory comments. Let us say there is a very skilled and brilliant doctor who has saved many from imminent death. However, this doctor is also acutely money conscious and his fees are high. If your purse is empty, you can forget about getting this doctor to even look at you, no matter how desperate your situation is. Let us now analyze the behavior of this rather money-conscious doctor in the context of our present discussion. Suppose we were to ask the doctor why he was so particular about money. He would probably reply, "Why not? Do you know how much I have had to spend to acquire these skills? Do you know how hard I have worked? When a company executive works hard, does he not get compensated adequately? I am self-employed. I run my own clinic. I have to pay my staff good salaries so that I get good service from them. That is why I pay myself a good salary. And how do I do this? By charging fees that are commensurate with the kind and quality of medical attention and service I give. What's wrong with that? Especially when I give my everything to the patients under my care. From a worldly point of view, all this might sound very reasonable, but you and I would probably say, wait a minute, doctor, your point is no doubt well taken, but don't you think you are different from a company executive? You are a healer and you have taken an oath to heal. Can healing be decoupled from compassion? How can you simply allow a person to die when the charity hospitals for the poor do not have a doctor with the kind of rare expertise you possess? Can you forsake a patient who throws himself at your mercy? Can you put money above compassion? At the purely worldly level, one can go on arguing like this till the cows come home. But if spiritual considerations are injected, and such considerations cannot be set aside, if spiritual considerations are injected, then the perspective changes totally. Saving a life is the only consideration, and money simply does not come into the picture because that is what Mama Dharma dictates. What about compensations for services rendered? The answer would be, to whom is this service rendered? Is it not to God in disguise? That point may not cut much ice with people who go solely by worldly logic, but in spirituality, believe me, this is a key point. Further, and it is well to remember this, God does not leave the love offered to him unrecognized. That is to say, if the doctor does not turn down poor patients but treats them with the same care and attention he bestows on those who pay, then God in his mercy would certainly reward the doctor in his own sweet way. Man may forget God, but God never forgets man. That is the assurance that God always gives when he incarnates. He did this when he came as Krishna, and is doing the same now in the physical form of our beloved Swami. That is something we ought not to forget, never ever. To proceed further, it is useful to keep in mind a wonderful analogy that the Lord himself has given concerning the relationship between the ephemeral body and the immortal soul. Swami has extensively elaborated on this in earlier years, and I shall now give you a gist of all that. The analogy is simply this. The body is like a chariot drawn by horses, while the soul, or the Lord, is like the charioteer. This should make abundantly clear which of the two, namely the chariot and the charioteer, is transient and which is permanent. Remember what Swami often tells us about action. He says, act in the present and in the world, but keeping always the eternal in view. In terms of the analogy I am now discussing, it means that the chariot must move forward in the world, remembering, however, that the one who is riding the chariot is none other than the Lord himself. In practical terms, this implies a lot of do's and don'ts concerning the way we act. Let us therefore spend a few minutes reviewing those golden rules. Clearly, since the Lord himself is riding the chariot, every care must be taken to ensure that the chariot is A, well taken care of, and B, that it moves forward properly, taking due instructions from the charioteer. You may not be aware of it, but over here, the people who drive Swami's cars are absolutely meticulous in taking care of it. For example, some days, Swami comes for darshan and then goes out for a short drive. He may go to the hospital to see a patient, or he may go to a construction site to see how a building under construction is coming up, or whatever. When the car goes out, it becomes a bit dirty. besides which it picks up a lot of flowers that devotees gather along the roadside, invariably throw at the car as an offering to Swami. The moment Swami returns to the mandir and goes inside into the interview room, the car is taken away for a rapid cleaning, after which it comes back again to the mandir to be of further service to Swami. Every morning and afternoon, long before Swami is due to come out for darshan, the car is wiped clean, spick and span, and a fresh garland is wrapped around the bonnet. The tire pressures are regularly checked, and the batteries are kept properly charged. Fuel is added well in time, and regular maintenance schedule is meticulously observed. In addition, whenever Swami is due to go out on a long trip, like to Bangalore or Kodai, all the preliminary checkouts are done thoroughly well in advance. What I am driving at is the meticulous attention given to the Lord's vehicle. Drawing inspiration from this, the first lesson we must learn is that since our own body is also a vehicle used by Swami day in and day out, it means we have an enormous obligation to keep it in top-class condition all the time. Are we doing it? One may wonder, we all know what maintaining a car in top condition means. Has Swami said anything about how we should keep His living car, namely our bodies, in good condition? Of course, and time sutra number two. It all starts with food. Everyone knows that without food the body would perish, which is why the Vedas proclaim Annam Brahma, meaning food is God, which by the way is also the reason why Swami repeatedly cautions, food is God, do not waste food. All this is well known, but what more can one say about being careful with food? Plenty. To start with, one must eat the proper food in right quantities and only at the right time. In earlier times, life was so regulated that this routine became a way of life, which meant that one did not have to pay particular attention to it. The discipline concerning food was automatic, having been drilled into every person by his or her parents. That was the prevailing ambience. But today, every effort is made to violate these ancient precepts in every possible way. Current fashion seems to be, food is to be enjoyed and is meant for sense gratification rather than for sustaining the chariot of the Lord in good condition. It is thanks to this new fashion that so-called junk food and eating at arbitrary times has become almost a global phenomenon. In fact, in many places, people are literally trapped into eating junk food. I once heard a radio program broadcast from America where a woman was asked why she ate so much fast food and got into trouble with obesity, diabetes, etc. In reply, she said, "Look, I am helpless. I have to work for a living, and my work involves a lot of travel. Even though I slog a lot, my salary is low. The net result is that A, I cannot afford to buy vegetables, fruits, etc. that you say are good for health. B, I simply do not have the time to cook proper meals. So, what choice do I have except to eat in a hamburger joint where I get a huge meal for $1.99? Maybe this food is not good for me, but it enables me to make both ends meet and keeps me going at least for the moment." That is what I meant by the traps of modern society and current lifestyle. Let me get back to the main theme and continue with the topic of food. In the ancient Indian tradition, food was not merely declared to be God, but also treated with reverence. Food was regarded as a blessing conferred by the Universal Mother, which is why one of her many names is Mata Annapurneshwari, which means mother who showers her grace by giving us food. Moreover, food was always offered first to God, and a bit of it was then offered to ancestors. I recall the drill my mother used to go through every day in the matter of preparing food. First, she would have her bath, after which she would go through her own routine of japam, prayers, etc. It was only after that she would start cooking. All the time while cooking, she would be mumbling some sloka or the other. And when the cooking was over, she would bring all the vessels containing the cooked food and place them in the altar. There, she would chant some prayers and offer the food to God. Having offered the food first to God, she would then take a small amount of rice, roll it into a few balls, and then go out into the courtyard. There, she would place the balls of rice on the ground, after which she would call out to the crows. It was the ancient Indian practice to feed the crow every day. The folklore was that parents and ancestors came in the form of crows and that it was our obligation to feed them. But the real significance was to thank the crow that played the role of a scavenger in nature's scheme of things. In those days, expression of gratitude was mandatory at every conceivable stage of human activity. Of course, to cap it all, when food was served, no one ate till the elders went through their own routine of chanting all the mandated Vedic hymns, offering the food to God, etc., etc. Swami has discussed this extensively in the old days and talked about it many times to students. But since life has become a whirlwind, Swami has kindly compressed everything to a simple chant of Brahmarpanam. That's the routine we follow these days. Getting back to what Swami has said about the food we eat, in a nutshell, he has stressed two aspects. Firstly, everything about the food must be pure, including the basic ingredients and the vessels in which they are cooked. Further, the person doing the cooking must be clean and have pure thoughts while engaged in cooking. Of course, food must be partaken only after first offering it to God. And while eating, one must remain silent and not engage in aimless and frivolous chit-chat. The point is pertinent since these days, many eat while watching TV. Swami has also given much advice about what kind of food we should eat, as also the quantity we must consume. Since much of this is well known, I shall not repeat it here. Instead, I wish to call attention to a point that is not so well known, which is that the term food has a much broader meaning than what we normally understand it to be. Swami says that food is not only what we eat, but also what we offer to the various senses. Thus, the term food has broader implications, and in turn, it imposes greater responsibilities on us. To amplify, while the muscles get their food via the mouth, aided by the tongue and the teeth, the mind gets its food via the eyes, the ears, the sense of touch, and the sense of smell. This means that we must be extremely careful, for example, about what we see and what we hear, which is why the ancients stress repeatedly, see no evil and hear no evil. But these days, just consider how many hours people spend watching TV, hooked on and completely mesmerized by the trash that is presented. What about the ear? How much time is spent on gossip, listening to rubbish and so on? In short, healthy living means not only paying attention to the kind of food that the body gets, but also the kind of diet that the mind receives through the various senses. All this translates, of course, into mind and sense control. These days, people get very upset the moment this topic is mentioned. They flare up and retort, "Are you crazy? I am a free person. I am liberated, not shackled by old fuddy-duddy ideas like you have. Life is meant for enjoyment, and don't try to fill me with killjoy ideas. Where do you think the senses came from? Has not God given them to us? If He did not want us to use the senses, then why did He give them to us?" Swami has answered all these so-called objections. He says, "Bangaru, you have evolved from lower living species. God in His mercy has given the senses to all living beings, and in humans, the senses are most comprehensive. They have been given to you for you to survive in the external world. Animals use the senses strictly for the purpose for which God intended them. But in your case, you are exceeding the limits by granting yourself some extra licenses. This you should not do. God does not ask you to suspend the use of your senses, not at all. He only wants you to be very careful in using them. Swami adds, he says, a car has brakes. But does anyone ask you to drive a car with one foot on the brakes? No. Brakes are meant to be used only in an emergency. Though you may not use them constantly, you must not forget to use them when in need. In the same way, I am not asking you to switch off all your senses and live in a cocoon, not at all. However, always be careful and use the brakes when required. Life these days has become like driving in a crowded, narrow lane. Can you drive at reckless speed under those conditions? Would you not be careful if you want to avoid an accident? So it is with life. That, in essence, is what Swami is telling us. It is appropriate at this point to call attention to the discourses that Swami gave in 1976 during the summer course. That year, the summer course was not held in Vrindavan, as is usually the case, but in the hill station Ooty, and the proceedings are available in book form with the title Summer Roses in the Blue Mountains. I strongly urge you to go through that book. Many a chapter there begins with words like, do you know why God has given you eyes? Is it to look at this and that? And so on. In short, in my opinion, this book is a wonderful manual for maintaining the divine chariot called the human body. Don't miss at least glancing through it. I will now address an important question that confronts most people. Modern worldly logic often reduces to an either-or proposition. Things are either this or that. It cannot be both. On the other hand, Vedanta maintains that one cannot take a black and white approach to things, at least in many cases. It should instead be this and that, depending on the circumstances and in balanced proportion. This might sound very puzzling, no surprise in that. So let me now spend some time on this topic, since it is very pertinent to what we are discussing now. As the Lord reminds us, we are a mixture of the body and soul. While the body is the means, so to speak, the soul is the goal. In practical terms, we must give a balanced attention to both our worldly duties enjoined upon us by the body and also to the cosmic responsibilities we carry on account of the presence of the soul within us. Way back in 2000 during the summer course, and I remember this very clearly, Swami explained all this very beautifully. He said, why do you think God has given you two legs? Can you walk with just one leg? Try it. You can't. When you walk, you use both legs. You take one step with the left leg, then one with the right, and so on. Thus, walking goes according to the rhythm, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, and so on. Same with life. You walk left, right, and when the time is right, you leave the left behind. That was a wonderful play on words, but what Bhagwan Baba means is that we must act in the world, keeping, however, spiritual considerations in view all the time. Thus, it is not either or, but both this and that. This philosophy always holds and is quite practical. We live in the present and must necessarily act in the present. At the same time, we must act so that long-term objectives are properly fulfilled. This applies to everything we do in life, studies, investment, savings, etc., etc. And yet these days, what is the governing philosophy? Everyone, from individuals to companies and even governments, seem to say, to hell with the future, the present is all that matters, survival is the name of the game. Yes, survival is indeed the name of the game, but survival in what sense? That is the question that the Gita raises and answers. It says, Mister, if you want to survive in the short term, then be assured that you would perish in the long term. However, if you make long-term survival your goal, then with full faith in God, no matter what the present problems are, you would always come out of it. That's what the Gita says. In short, when we act, we have to keep multiple considerations in view and not respond to situations with a knee-jerk type of reaction based on false either-or logic. It's interesting to note that the information technologies follow a multiple-tier procedure when they establish links between one information system and another. They have what are called levels of protocol. Links must be established between two systems at every level of protocol. If you miss one level, the system begins to malfunction straight away. This, by the way, is also true of the way two countries relate to each other. At the highest level, it is the head of one country that has contacts with its counterpart in the other country. Lower down, there are many other levels like the ministerial level, official level, and so on, going all the way down to people-to-people level. So, this multiple levels of functioning that I am talking about, being both in the present and in the distant future, is not something pulled out of a hat. In fact, it is something quite common. Only we fail to notice it and appreciate its significance. To wrap up this part of the discussion, it is precisely because each of us is a delicate combination of the ephemeral body and the mortal soul that Swami says in the Gita Vahini, your actions might be in the present and in this world, but they must always be based on considerations of the eternal. Satya and Dharma are eternal, being aspects of God. Therefore, if you want to please God, always adhere to Satya and Dharma, no matter what the cost. I hope that is clear. I would like to stress that the emphasis given to the permanent aspect underlying the human being has a deep meaning. These days, people are not bothered about the soul, except maybe in a sort of distant and philosophical way. Such people are invariably self-centered, with self-interest motivating most of their actions. People are becoming increasingly self-centered and driven almost entirely by self-interest. Whenever a decision is to be made, the person concerned invariably asks, if I act in this way, what's there in it for me? Self-interest is nothing new and is as old as the human race itself. It is born in our lower self and is related to our evolutionary past as lower beings. Its root is what I have earlier referred to as the lower mind. Just to remind you, what is usually called the mind is a vast continuum, extending from the lower mind at one extreme to the higher mind at the other extreme. The lower mind tends to drag us towards the external world, to the present, and to the so-called worldly success as well as transient pleasures. The Gita refers to all this simply as prayers. I mentioned that word before. By contrast, the higher mind directs us towards our primordial source, namely God. The focus is thus on the eternal and the values that spring from that. The Gita calls this Shreyas. Man is thus constantly torn between prayers and Shreyas, and this inner struggle rages endlessly within everyone all the time. The head, which symbolizes the force of prayers, pulls man one way, while the heart that symbolizes Shreyas pulls him the other way. If you think about it, the Mahabharata war is nothing but a portrayal in the outer world of the inner struggle. In the war fought on the battlefield in Kurukshetra, one side chose the armies of Krishna, while the other side chose Krishna himself, despite the fact Krishna refused to physically bear arms and fight. In the end, it was the side guided by Krishna that won. The message is loud and clear. Turn your mind towards God and seek refuge in Him. You may face a tough road, but you will certainly get there in the end. Which is why Swami tells us that the mind is like a key and bliss is like a lock on a door. Turn the key one way and the door gets locked. Turn the key the other way and the door opens. Turn your mind towards the world and get sucked into the frightening whirlpool of samsara. Turn your mind towards God and He will help you to experience ananda or permanent bliss. So you see, the same idea of making the right choice between the transient, which appears to come in a glittering package, and the eternal that seems so bitter, at least to start with, can be expressed in many different ways. However, the bottom line is always the same. Surrender completely to God, and He would take care of everything. Okay, but what has all this got to do with the theme of body and soul? That is the question I shall now discuss briefly. And to do that, I have to go back all the way to creation itself. You see, as Krishna emphatically tells Arjuna, God is eternal, formless, and all by Himself, so to speak. However, at times, He projects a bit of Himself onto a substratum called space-time. And when He does that, the universe is born. It is because God has created the universe, He is sometimes called the creator, and the universe itself is referred to as creation. While the creator is permanent, the universe is transient. The beauty is that having willed the universe into existence, God does not totally stay away from it. Instead, He hides Himself in every entity in the universe, from the atom to the galaxies, watching all the time, helping and guiding if He is prayed to. He thus plays a passive as well as an active role, depending on the circumstances. What I am driving at is that the universe itself is a mysterious mix of gross matter and immanent God. Since we are a part of the gross universe, no wonder there is a part of us that is transient, but there is also a part of us that is permanent. The advice that Krishna gave to Arjuna was, when you have to act, decide on the course of your action by reflecting upon the permanent aspect rather than the ephemeral. This way, you would be assured that you are perfectly aligned to Satya and Dharma. And remember, you cannot afford to be misaligned if you want to get where you finally want to go, that is to Me. And by the way, that really is what Mama Dharma boils down to, getting aligned to Satya and Dharma in implementing all actions. In this Kali age, the relationship between the body and soul acquires a very special meaning that few have bothered to appreciate. We often tend to think that the soul is something internal to us and is literally somewhere within the body. As Krishna pointed out and as Swami has reminded us again and again, while the soul does speak to us from within as the voice of conscience, it is universal and hence omnipresent. In fact, it is meaningless to think in terms of my soul, his soul, her soul, and so on. There is only one universal soul, the universal spirit, the Atma, Brahman, call it what you will. That indescribable and permanent entity permeates everything in creation, and it's always present in a subtle form everywhere, all the time. It is that mysterious, indescribable power that we sometimes refer to as God. It is that power that manifests variously as the life force of prana, creativity, compassion, divine love, and whatnot. These days, when humans are so much interconnected, individuals tend to become fiercely protective of what they perceive as their own space. This leads to misunderstandings and quarrels, not only between father and son, mother and daughter, husband and wife, and so on, but also between various family members, members of the same community, people belonging to different communities, caste, religion, speaking different languages, people of different races, etc., etc., indeed at all possible levels. The tendency to stress diversity and differentiate becomes strong when one leans on the lower mind. On the other hand, if one leans towards the higher mind, it becomes an entirely different ball game. One would then see that though the bodies are different, we are all networked via the same universal soul or Atma. I repeat that, we are all networked via the same universal soul or the Atma. As Swami often reminds us, bulbs are many and varied, but the current that flows is one. So the question before us boils down to, do we give more weightage to the difference between us, differences that are related to the transient body, or do we attach more importance to the common bond, namely the universal and eternal Atma? If we choose to forget the common bond, then trouble invariably follows. And when there is strong global connectivity as now. There is also strong competition for resources like oil and water, and thereafter troubles can start and they can become really serious. Given that one, currently our population is growing at an alarming rate, two, non-renewable resources are being depleted rapidly, and three, the ecosystem is facing grave danger, it becomes very important to understand not only that there is a soul present in each and every one of us, but also that this very same soul binds all of us very strongly. In other words, contrary to our belief, the common bond that exists between all of us and with nature is far more important than all the factors that might differentiate us. The big lesson we must all learn today is that while diversity is an inherent part of nature, we cannot afford to let that diversity dictate our thinking. Rather, we must learn to live in harmony with diversity, which we can do only when we realize the importance of the soul or the Atma, and how the Atma is the universal glue that binds everything in creation. That key word is important, universal glue. In short, I would say, the 13th chapter helps in drawing our attention to 1. The cosmic origin of man, 2. His cosmic connections, 3. His cosmic responsibilities, and 4. His cosmic destiny. Swami, of course, does not use this language, but if we read carefully his discourses, we cannot fail to find that this precisely is his message. In summary, in this talk I have made the following points. 1. Life is based on actions, and actions are performed by the body-mind combination. 2. However, if the action is to be in conformity with Mama Dharma, which is what Swami wants, then we must not forget the spirit or the soul or the Atma, whatever we may call it. 3. This Atma pervades everything. It is everywhere, and being eternal is present all the time. Thus, it is also within us. 4. Krishna draws pointed attention to the Atma in 13th chapter by dealing with the subject of body-soul relationship. 4. The Lord says that while the body is like a chariot, the Lord is a charioteer. 6. This automatically implies that the chariot, namely the body, must move forward in the manner in which the charioteer or the Lord wants. 7. In practical terms, this boils down to doing God's will. Translated to plain language, it simply means that we have to adhere to Mama Dharma at all times and in all circumstances. 8. Further, in today's context, following Mama Dharma implies special responsibilities. This is because the planet has become very crowded. When people living in a highly crowded planet are driven by strong self-interest and selfish considerations, there would inevitably be clashes born out of instincts promoted by the lower mind. And we see a lot of it today. And there is even greater danger for the planet itself being harmed, not to speak of society, and that of course comes from global warming, which again is the result of selfishness. 9. Thus, Mama Dharma acquires a special cosmic significance in today's world, which Swami calls attention to via the quartet of words. I have mentioned this before. Vyashti or the individual, Samashti or society, Srishti or creation, and Parameshti or God. 10. In short, our actions must always be rooted in considerations of the permanent rather than the transient. When we do that, automatically our actions would neither harm society nor disturb nature. 11. And this is my last point. To put it differently, the world would be very different if, say, not 100%, but even 70% of people adhere to Mama Dharma. With love for God everywhere and with everyone abhorring sin, peace and harmony must necessarily follow. They will follow. It is a guarantee, not given by me, but by God Himself. Well, that's the gist of what I've been trying to tell you today. I'm not sure, but I hope I did get through. Thanks for listening, and all the best till we get together again. May God be with you always. Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu. Jai Sai Ram.
You have been listening to Professor Venkatraman deliver a talk in the Musing series on the Gita.
Tune in again next week at the same time to hear the next talk in this series. This broadcast came to you from the studios of Radio Sai in Prashanti Nilayam. If you have any comments on this or indeed on any of our other programs, please do write to us. Our email ID is listener@radiosai.org. Once again, our email ID is listener@radiosai.org. Please note that Radio Sai is one word.